This is All Things Git, the podcast about Git. I'm Edward Thompson.
And I'm Sarah Ford.
So my usual co-host, Martin Woodward, isn't able to make it today. Thankfully, I've got Sarah Ford to fill in for him. You might remember Sarah from episode number 3, where she talked about human factors in software and getting started with Git. I think we've got a great episode. And if you like the show, please rate us on the iTunes Store or in the Google Play Store. And be sure to follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. We're at All Things Git. We're going to talk today about GitHub Universe. GitHub Universe is a conference that GitHub puts on to talk about the GitHub ecosystem. It took place October 10th through the 12th in San Francisco. And I was there. I had the pleasure of speaking there. But I was honestly like super busy. And thankfully, Sarah was also there, and she is going to fill me in on everything that I missed. So, Sarah, welcome back.
Thanks, Ed.
So the thing that I remember the most about GitHub Universe is the smoke. So for listeners who aren't aware, who aren't from like the western, southwestern United States, around the Bay Area, you might not know that there were some major forest fires around the Napa and Sonoma Valley area. And so I got into San Francisco. I'm not from San Francisco, right? I live in the UK. So I flew in, I woke up in my hotel room, super jet lagged the first night at like 4 a.m. and I could smell smoke. And I'm not sure there's anything more terrifying than being 15 floors up in a place you've never been before and realizing that you're inhaling smoke.
Oh, wow. Because you would be in a hotel room. I was just thinking about my experience when I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I live just south of the San Francisco airport. And I woke up and I'm like, smoke, gotta get out, gotta get out. I was like halfway to the door of escaping my apartment when I realized, wait a minute, I'm not hearing alarms yet. And then I stopped. I was like, you know, like, well, maybe it's outside. No, well, what is it? And then, yeah, it took me a little bit to figure out what was going on. It was that strong, but I can't imagine, at least I was at home. I can't imagine being like in a hotel with that.
Yeah,
that,
it totally took me a little while. Yeah, it took me a minute to realize that, you know, I was probably okay. You know, I looked outside. I'm like, where's the fire? It was that strong. It was incredible. And thankfully it got better by at least the first day of GitHub Universe. GitHub Universe itself is actually somewhat open air. The venue is, it's at Pier 70 in San Francisco. And so the smoke was pretty bad the second day. Is that right? Like at the event?
I want to say that the first day was worse than the second day. Like it was slowly getting better.
I see.
But I remember on that first day, you could hold, like put your phone down and you could start to see the ash start to accumulate over a while, over like maybe 20, 30 minutes, like at lunchtime. So I tried to do what I could to just kind of stay inside the facility, even though it was kind of open air, but I thought, okay, at least it's better than nothing. But I remember my eyes being a little dry, watery, just from like just so much of the smoke. But it did get better like the second day.
Wow. All right.
So poor you. You had to not only speak and be jet lagged, but you also had to deal with the smoke on the worst day.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know. It was a great event for me, even despite that. So, unfortunately, yeah, I had to cut out. I had to fly to another conference right after that, so I wasn't able to stick around for the second day. So I missed so much. There were so many big announcements. For example, GitHub announced GitHub Desktop 1.0. We talked to Brendan Forrester, actually, episode number 1, the very first episode of this podcast. We talked to Brendan about GitHub Desktop. And so it's great to see that they were doing a 1.0. What are you doing these days? We talked a little bit the last time we had you on about Git GUIs. What do you think about the Git GUI experience?
I tell people about GitHub Desktop in the context of if you want to use, if you're more comfortable with GUIs, here's like you have these options. But I also talk to people about GitHub Desktop for enabling, for if you have 2FA to help get your setup up and running, because that was one of those pain points that I had. I had years ago, I enabled 2FA, and next thing you know, like on the command line, it was prompting me every single time for a PIN that was sent to my phone. And if I had only known about GitHub Desktop, if I had just installed it and never used it again, it would have alleviated my pain. But yeah, I think about the desktop. For me, I haven't found a Git GUI yet that really clicks for me. And I'm not quite sure why. I guess it's just I have a different visualization of what's going on in my head that others, and maybe I have to just I haven't tried enough different GUIs yet. But I have a feeling that we're kind of like with Git, like we're still in the early days of DOS, where everything was command line. And as it got more and more widespread adoption, the graphical user interface came along, and next thing you know, you have a mouse. And I'm wondering if we're about 5 years out from that sort of like revolution in a sense, that we're going to see some sort of like GUI breakthrough of like, hey, here is the canonical way to visualize what's happening in a repo, that you could click and click on different commits and do different things and not worry about, okay, what is the command that I need to run to control this underlying plumbing, that the GUI could match the mental model of what is the action that I want to achieve. So yeah, that's my theory. I think within the next 5 years that we're going to have a breakthrough. It's just going to have to happen.
Interesting. So talking about GUIs, one of the other things that they announced were some of the changes to the GitHub extension for Visual Studio. Did you see any of that stuff?
Yes, I was really happy to see this one, since that was the team that was on before I left on GitHub. So I knew they were working, that it was in the plans to be worked on for a while. So I was happy to see that feature ship. And yeah, so now you can actually, in Visual Studio, on the line of code that you're looking at, you can click I forget where the button is, but you basically can click a button that has an experience just like on the website to be able to leave a comment for a particular line of code. So instead of having to jump out of Visual Studio to the website to leave an inline comment, you can just comment within the IDE and it will send it up to GitHub. And it was kind of funny, the first time I saw the feature, I was playing with the feature, I just like flashed back to 15 years ago doing accessibility testing and accessibility PMing for Visual Studio. I'm like, okay, how would you implement the iAccessible interface for this? And I'm like, wait, what am I doing? Wait, no, 2017. I don't have to think about it. There is no more iAccessible interface. Like, it was just funny. That was like my knee-jerk reaction. Like, it goes to show how long I worked on accessibility. But yeah, it's actually really just, I love how they're simplifying that process for leaving feedback, because the more you can do in the IDE, the faster that you will be, and the more likely you will be able to contribute feedback.
Yeah, I totally agree. So many people don't like that context switch between GitHub.com, the website, or, you know, whatever your code hosting platform is, GitLab or Visual Studio Team Services, whatever, and their code editor, whether that's, you know, Visual Studio or VI or whatever, you know, that context switch can be really expensive for some people. And I think it's probably really expensive for me. I do it anyway, and I suffer. So maybe I actually need to get with the more modern era and pay attention to this GitHub, the GitHub extension for Visual Studio, which I don't use very often. I actually don't use Visual Studio very often. So that's really? My current excuse.
Wait, stop. Like, time out. Wait, explain this. Explain this to me. Like, what do you use if you're not using Visual Studio?
So now that I'm a program manager at Microsoft, most of my time is spent in Outlook and PowerPoint. You know, okay, PowerPoint is Turing complete. Did you know that? You can actually program in PowerPoint. How terrifying is that? I'll put a...
That's right. I've seen the video. And so, yeah, and you still get to use F5. You get
right.
to use the PM F5, which is to launch a slideshow.
That's exactly right. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes, because that video is terrifying. I usually use VI, and I don't know why. Because most of the code I write is C.
We are like on the opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of, you know, I want an IDE and I want to click things. And you're like, I just want VI and like just you know, use your crazy like keyboard shortcuts to do everything.
That's right. That's right. I want to use VI. I want to be able to hit Control Z and get a shell, and then I want to type make from that shell. I mean, I guess I could have two terminal windows side by side if I'm feeling particularly advanced. I started programming, you know, on a machine that I couldn't run X on. So I'm not real good with visual stuff, it turns out. But
All right. Fair enough.
It's not fair. It's terrible. I'm just an old retro grouch now. So Sarah, what were you doing at GitHub Universe? You work at Microsoft. You work on the Azure Active Directory B2C team. Why were you at GitHub Universe? Why weren't you at like Build or Ignite or one of the Microsoft conferences?
Well, I wanted to go to GitHub Universe because I want to keep up with everything that I learned from GitHub, from being an employee at GitHub. And I want to keep up with, okay, what is coming out next? What does the industry look like? What are the community statistics happening at GitHub? I just wanted to keep up to date. And with it being right down the street from me, there was like, I had no excuse. I just had to go. Stay up to date. And it was like the one thing I've noticed since I've taken a break from public speaking, because I would always go to these conferences and give talks, but I never had a chance to ever be an attendee. And for the past couple of years, I've actually been an attendee, and for the first time really ever. And it's been wonderful because I get to go to the sessions that I'm interested in. I don't have like the, okay, I need to prep. Like, you know, like when you're a speaker, it's like life does not continue, or there is no such thing as life until after your talk.
It's true.
Because all you're doing is prepping for that talk. And here it's like, oh, I have no stress. I can go to the attendee party. I can, you know, go and visit the booths. I can ask, okay, what's in it for me in terms of like my own weekend projects. And yeah, so between wanting to stay, keep up to date, and also just, you know, being able to experience what it's like to be an attendee. Yeah, I definitely wanted to go. And the next time I get back into doing more and more speaking, it's definitely being an attendee is giving me a lot more insights of like what I might try to do differently. But yeah.
Oh, that's really awesome. That's cool. So you're totally right. And I'm totally sympathetic because I feel like I haven't been an attendee in a while. I've only been speaking. So yeah, I flew in. I was totally focused on the talk I was about to give. I gave the talk. And then I flew out. So I missed everything. I missed everything but the keynote. I was able to see the keynote, and I thought that was really impressive. You mentioned some of the things that they had announced. They announced a bunch of statistics at the keynote, and I don't know about you, but they totally blew my mind. We both worked at GitHub, and I had no idea the scale, like, of some of the things that they were going to announce. Like, so many people are creating their first pull requests in the last year. It's outstanding.
I know. They said at the keynote it was 3.3K first PRs a day. So 3,300 first PRs every single day.
That's insane.
And I'm like, no, that can't be right. I must have mistyped it or something like that. So I went to the GitHub Octaverse 2017 report, and sure enough, it says 1.2 million people made their first pull request since September 2016. And so divide that number by 365, and yeah, you have about roughly 3,300 first PRs a day. And I have so many questions about that number, because by people, do they mean like
users?
Registered, like I'm going to assume like a user, like a registered account. But I would love to know just like a little bit more about that data. Is it based on, like, what if you looked at it based on IP address? It just feels too high. That's where I'm going with this. It just felt too high. Like, are there that many people entering? Maybe I'm being totally naive here, but are there like that many people entering computer science that you could have that number?
Yeah, it seems crazy to me too. I mean, yeah, for sure. Some of them are probably bots, but still that's impressive no matter what.
No, yeah. I got to give credit where credit is due. And that is like a phenomenal number.
Yeah, it's great. It's wonderful to see the number of people. I mean, I assume that's not just open source projects. I assume that is both open source and, of course, you can host your own, you know, your company's proprietary closed source products
on GitHub.com. I didn't think about that.
Yeah, but still, that's a crazy number. It just shows the how popular the whole pull request process is and how popular GitHub is, both.
That's true, because I didn't think about if you're not like already have an account at GitHub, but you're in the industry and your company, either you switch jobs or you join a company that, or you're at your company, they decide they're going to start hosting either public or private repositories on GitHub. So yeah, you're already a software engineer, but it's just that you're now having to adopt GitHub. So yeah, I guess that does explain a lot. I was thinking of like new to programming first pull requests. So that's okay.
Right.
So that helps me make a little bit more sense of the number.
Right. So I mean, let's take you for an example. You've got, you're working on Azure AD B2C, and I assume that you're using Visual Studio Team Services, because you know everybody in Microsoft does, right? For your sort of proprietary stuff, but you've got a GitHub account, and your team hosts stuff on GitHub. Do you have like open source projects or something? Because you're the kind of end user facing stuff. Do you have APIs or something?
We have on my immediate team, we have our samples, our Azure AD B2C samples are
right.
On GitHub. The like sister teams, we have our libraries, like the MSAL library. So those are also open source projects as well. So yeah, so there are projects out there. Yeah, so we're using GitHub for.
Cool. Yeah, so that makes sense. So everybody on your team has to create, you know, their own pull requests. They all made their first pull request, even though some of them were veteran programmers. And I'm sure some of the people on your team are coming right out of school and, you know, getting started with GitHub. It's crazy.
Yeah, I thought you were going to go a different route with that question because I only created my GitHub account like maybe 3 years ago. I have to go back. It's been pretty recent. Yeah, like 2.5-3 years ago. And I was joking that the name, I was both happy and sad to see that Sarah Ford was still available on GitHub. And I think it was Phil Hack. He I said this on Twitter, and he replied back and said, "Welcome. We've been holding this spot for you."
Oh.
Yeah, I was like, "Oh, yeah, I know, right?" but yeah. So like all the veteran programmers who, it's not like you're new to programming. You might just be now using GitHub for the first time. Yeah. So yeah, I just misread the what the first pull request was implying.
Yeah,
in my own mind.
That's my assumption. I'm also reading into that, but yeah, I mean, just some crazy, crazy numbers. I mean, GitHub.com is just so big and so popular. Both again, you know, and it's not just open source. Although that's the obvious view of that I have of GitHub is like open source, but it's not just that.
Well, and maybe a listener has like their own interpretation as well, and we'll continue to like. Draw out this Venn diagram of what consists of this first PR. And, you know, I was thinking of the book Wisdom of Crowds. Maybe we could come up with a good diagram of how this number is broken down.
Yeah, interesting. I'm not familiar with the book, but I'll...
The Wisdom of Crowds?
Yeah.
It's an interesting read, but the TLDR, since we're, you know, talking about GitHub, the TLDR is I think it has to be... You have to have at least a little bit of domain expertise. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong. But the idea is that the people in the audience as a collective know more than you as a speaker on any given subject.
Whoa.
It was like the idea is it comes from the thing about like the jelly beans, like how many jelly beans are in a jar.
Uh-huh.
And over time, if you have like enough samples, people will start to get it right. Even though it's just because everyone has held a jelly bean in their hand so they can make some sort of like prediction. And I want to say there was something about like, I'll just use Visual Studio for example. But if you were in like a room of like 100, 200 people and you asked each person how many lines of code are in Visual Studio, as in like the Visual Studio IDE, or like just say like the C# Express version. If you, the more people that you get, on the average, the number will tend to come close to the actual the actual real life number. So that's what the Wisdom of Crowds book is kind of like implying.
Whoa, you totally just blew my mind. So like,
now I'm gonna have to reread this book again to make sure I got this all right. But that is the idea that the people, I have it like on my bookshelf. I'm like looking at it, I'm like wanting to grab it and read the back of it. But it's basically the idea is like the crowd actually knows more than you as a speaker.
Wow. Okay. I've got to read this book. B, hold on. Let me just make sure I understood you. You're saying that like people with crazy uneducated guesses about the number of lines of code in Visual Studio, you know, somebody's going to say like 5,000 and somebody's going to say like 100 billion or something just completely ridiculous. But despite those outliers, you're telling me that the average will actually, you know, sort of be accurate.
If I'm remembering correctly, and this can't be uneducated guesses, like they have to be software engineers. I just go to Caltrain. Well, I was going to say, I can't just get on the Caltrain and say, in this train that goes into San Francisco and say, hey, everyone, how many lines of code are in Visual Studio? But then I started laughing because everyone is an engineer.
you can in fact do that. Yeah.
but as long as you have some sort of domain expertise, you can kind of start to guess. And yeah, so it starts off with the number of jelly beans in the jar and kind of goes from there. But it's been a while, and so if someone's listening and I'm like, I'm totally off base, we can always go and do an edit of this. But yeah, that's the idea. It's like over, it either converges or people will actually start to guess it right.
Wow, that's truly insane. I never would have thought about that. Okay, I got to read this book, but real quick, let's get back to GitHub universe. One of the other statistics I saw was that there are 4.2 million Atom users now. Atom, the text editor that's based on Electron, of course. And that number blows my mind too. But I think that they also announced something about Atom, the IDE.
Oh yeah, that's right. They announced Atom IDE. I haven't had a chance to really like explore it yet, but it was done in collaboration with Facebook. And when I saw this, I just couldn't help but just like smile, like have this big grin on my face, because the first time I wrote a package for Atom, the feedback I got was, you're trying to turn Atom into Visual Studio with all these like tool windows. And I burst out laughing. It was like, oh, of course, that is exactly what I'm doing. So it felt very validating when I heard about this, about the Atom IDE. I was in the talk where they mentioned it. I remember just briefly some screenshots, but just the fact that they called it Atom IDE, and that was the feedback I got on my first Atom package, just made me smile.
Yeah, that's funny. I think that Atom is going down that road a little bit. I mean, obviously with optional packages, but it looks like Visual Studio Code is too. It feels like these two sort of lightweight Electron-based code editors that launched at, you know, Visual Studio Code wasn't too long after Atom. It's funny to see them both just like grabbing new IDE features as quickly as they can.
Yeah, and I always looked at like the two on the opposite ends of the spectrum. Like VS Code is like, even though there's tons and tons of packages, it felt more of like, okay, we're going to guide you in your development activities and your development flow. Whereas Atom was just like a totally different end of the spectrum. Like go mix and match your packages without however you want to do your development. And for me, it was like, well, no, tell me exactly which ones I need for this particular developer experience that I want. So it's kind of interesting to see them kind of converge now towards the center. Maybe it is that Wisdom of Crowds. We all just converge to the center.
Wow, insane. So what other things did you learn about at GitHub Universe?
They mentioned ProBot.
ProBot, yeah. It's like QBot only, I guess, professional.
That, as I understand it, it's taking the more common functions of QBot and kind of like productizing it, called ProBot. I need to look at it more just for my own personal projects and see what I can do with it. But I mean, I played with QBot before in the past, and I'm glad that they're making it easier to get some of like QBot's features like into GitHub, that you could just like, hey, I want to have my bot I bought for my project, versus with QBot, there's a lot. QBot is this offering, but you have to do some work to get it set up. So I like the idea if you can just make it easier just to get things like already working for the end user.
Yeah, you have to do a lot of work to get it set up was what I remember. So for people who haven't used Hubot, who aren't familiar with Hubot, it's this thing that GitHub created, and they use it as part of what they call a chat ops workflow. So it lives kind of as a mix in Slack or some, you know, team room sort of setting and on GitHub. So you can do things like ask Hubot to, I don't know, deploy a PR to production. It's wild. It's so integrated into GitHub and their workflow that you can say things like, Hubot, please deploy to production. And all of a sudden, Hubot will in fact deploy a pull request to however many hundred servers GitHub has. And all of a sudden, GitHub.com in production is running this pull request. It's totally insane. And when you've tested that, when that pull request, you know, has been deployed and it looks good, then you can tell Hubot that everything's happy and it will actually merge that pull request for you. So it's all this like DevOps automation that GitHub has come up with, but it's really hard to set up. I always thought that Hubot was totally geared, you know, it was built by GitHub for GitHub, and anybody else trying to do anything with it would suffer a little bit. I mean, I guess you could jump through all the hoops to get it working, but I don't know if anybody did, certainly not to the level that GitHub did. So yeah, I totally agree. It's interesting to see Probot, and I guess they're bringing more of Hubot's functionality into like a turnkey offering so that you don't have to do all that setup. It'll be interesting to see if they can pull that off.
The only thing I used Hubot for in my, like in my personal, my personal apps for my own, like working on technical skills, is I had like my own personal kind of like Slack channel and had Hubot running in there, and I was able to send a command to Hubot to talk to the BB-8 little droid that was popular like a year or two ago. And you can, there's like it's a Spero, S-P-H-E-R-O, BB-8 little droid. And I had Hubot be able to talk to BB-8 to like send them commands and stuff like that, because I wanted to like learn JavaScript, and I wanted to, you know, like I bought this BB-8 Spero bot, and I'm like, or robot. And I'm like, what do you call this thing? It's like, it is a physical machine, so I guess you could call it a robot. And yeah, and so that's what I thought it would be fun to put to have Hubot talk to the BB-8. But yeah, I haven't. But yeah, I wouldn't even know how to get started. Like, but like we were describing with GitHub to be able to get Hubot into my actual projects, like you were describing. So yeah, I'm really happy to see that they're looking at Probot.
Yeah, me too. I contributed some stuff to our internal Hubot when I was at GitHub, but I don't like it's all node.js if I remember correctly.
It was messy. And I also used CoffeeScript, which took me a little bit to get my head wrapped around where because it's like white space has meaning, and that was just something like shocking to me.
I know TypeScript well enough. I don't need yet another thing that transpiles to JavaScript. So, all right, what else do we got? Something that I thought was really interesting was protected branches. They announced that now there are several ways to protect branches, and basically it makes sure that there are validations or gates, whatever you want to call them, to keep people from merging things into master until things have gotten approved.
Right. Yeah, I jotted down require reviews from code owners, check up to date before merging, and restrict who can push to a branch. I know they announced like there was like a couple of new ways to protect branches, so I'm not quite sure in that list if those were already existing features. But I know like when I just kind of give my overview of GitHub type of talks, like I'm always telling people, you know, like why they shouldn't check into master, like it misses the entire point of get all the goodness that you can do once that concept of branching clicks. So yeah, but again, like for my own personal projects, I'm thinking, okay, what does that mean to protect the branch from myself, from making sure that things are like working before I push. But yeah, for like, I'm starting to think for even for my own team's like sample apps, what would it mean to what I could do to incorporate some of this functionality into those projects. If there is like across the board, like some guidance of like, hey, just have these things enabled by, not by default, but just like, hey, this is like the way to go when you're collaborating with the community.
Yeah, the right way to do it. Yeah, that makes sense. I feel like protected branches are for a small repository, probably not super necessary, but like we use them all the time. So in VSTS, building VSTS, we've got protected branches and we've got like code owners, and that totally makes sense to me. Like I may be able to approve a pull request or check right into an area that I'm an expert in, but if I go and contribute to the UI code, then there's no way anybody should let me check in UI code without, you know, validation, right? It's going to be ugly. It's not going to work. Nothing about it will be good. And then that's like the best case scenario until somebody turns on high DPI, and then it's even worse, right? But I can totally get why the branch protection exists, but that's interesting. It kind of clicks for me, but that's because I'm already using them, right? We've had those for a little while. So,
well, and you're working like the nature of the projects that you're working on versus like the, like I'm talking about community samples where it's like, hey, if you're going, if you want to contribute, I would love to, you know, see, you know, more and more contributions,
right?
But by default, they're people who are not in our immediate team are not going to have permissions anyway to write to master or other branches. They would have to be doing pull requests from their forked repo. But when you're right. Talking about internal teams, yeah, I haven't been in the world, like I haven't, since I've been a PM for the past 10 years, I haven't been in that world where I've been collaborating with like fellow devs and who has what rights. So it's been a while since I've had to think about those scenarios like you just described. Where do you control permissions? So you control it by because you are this person, you get permissions to do certain things, or is it because you are this user, which team you belong to, and those teams get rights to do certain things? And that maybe because of the way that the permissions work nowadays, that it's easier to protect like the branch than it is to assign a la carte permissions per individual people.
Right. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I guess it depends on, you know, it depends on the size of the team, the scope of the team, how they want to lay it out. I like that there are more options now for controlling these things.
Yeah, I said the other day that all these things are collaboration tools. These are suggestions of, you know, there are options. It's not going to solve how you communicate with your team. You still have to figure out how you're going to talk.
Right.
If anything, this kind of brings up to the surface like any collaboration issues you're already having.
Absolutely. Yeah. If there's one thing I've learned in the last however many episodes that we've been doing this podcast, it's that Git is really just a tool that allows people to communicate. I mean, it's yes, of course, building software is a technical challenge, but and I don't want to speak for all software developers, but for me, at least, the challenges aren't the technical ones as much as the collaboration and communication with other people. That's the part that is by far the hardest. You can make computers do things, right? People are much less malleable.
Yes, that is very true.
So did you see anything else at GitHub Universe that struck your fancy? Did you go to any of the sessions that totally blew you away? What was your favorite? What was your favorite session?
I love how there was this talk about how Microsoft became like the top contributor to GitHub.
That was a good talk, and I'm not at all biased by the fact that I gave it. Okay, yeah. Other than
but
my
I
talk,
did, but I did love your quote about open source isn't a zero sum game. That was a really great quote. I never considered it with that lens before.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so for me, you know, now I've worked at both Microsoft and GitHub, and I've worked on projects that both Microsoft and GitHub use, and both Microsoft and GitHub contribute to. And despite that, Microsoft and GitHub are competitors, right? So I work on Visual Studio Team Services, and I would like people to use that. And you know, fundamentally, VSTS and GitHub compete with each other. If VSTS and GitHub and GitLab compete with each other, and yet we all use the same open source libraries. So there's a measure of collaboration that you simply have to have when in this modern era. There's just so much open source, there's so much collaborative development that it's crucial to work with your competitors.
There was that quote, a rising tide raises all boats. And yes, I like to think about it like that.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
The talk that really stood out for me was the New York Times gave there was a developer there who showed that how they had their own CMS system that uses GitHub as a backend for reviewing and publishing opinion articles. So basically, like articles that were written by third parties to the New York Times.
Okay.
And they were talking about like how that came to be and how they handle merge conflicts. And when they have a merge conflict, the writer sees a image of like these people dancing around, and there's this comment: "We're all better when we work together. Please reload the page," and that so it can handle like the merge conflict. That just cracked me up. For all of us who have ever dealt with pain of merge conflicts, and then like this is the way that they presented it to their writers. So it was just it was kind of cool.
That is really cool.
It's all about perspective. Really cool. It is all about perspective.
Right.
Other things that jumped out at me. Shopify, they had a talk, and they were showing this spreadsheet of how they were keeping track of all their infrastructure before they automated it using GitHub's APIs. But they called the process of using a spreadsheet to keep track of everything as, quote, spreadsheet defined infrastructure.
Whoa.
And I have never heard that before, and that made me laugh. And then the last one is one of the lawyers at GitHub, who's I'm going to get her title wrong, but I believe she's in charge of all of, like, intellectual property. It's Tall. She gave a talk about some of the things that they're doing in terms of like what the lawyers are doing at GitHub, and some of the things like I always refer to it as kind of like bleeding edge, because I haven't seen other people do this. I remember when I was assigning up to like I was joining GitHub, and I was reading their IP agreement, and I'm like, wow, this is like so well written, and from the perspective of like a new employee joining the company, this is like amazing. And I shared the story because they have their GitHub has open source their employee IP agreement, and it had like the most points on Hacker News for a GitHub story. This is all from Tal's talk, and so it was and they like her talk, they kind of talked about like how GitHub came to figure out what they called a fair and balanced IP agreement. And so it was just really neat to kind of hear from like the lawyers' perspectives of how they were driving this forward. And what I didn't know was that even fast food workers have to sign IP agreements. She mentioned that, and I was like, wow, fast food workers signing IP agreements, I had no idea. That's something that I should look up on my on my own, because I'm just really curious about it. And then GitHub has other open source policies, and they're all in can you tell I've rejoined Microsoft? GitHub.com/GitHub/site-policy.
Very cool. Yeah, so I think GitHub Universe was a really great event. I'm happy to have been a part of it. It sounds like you had a good time too. So what a wonderful experience. And
I have to say, one of the things that made it such a great experience for me was that I had a friend come into town for Universe, and this was his first big conference led by a company. I'm like, And he's been to other, you know, kind of smaller like conferences. What's the term I'm trying to say? Like more for like, okay, here's like a particular like meetup groups or things like that. But this was his first conference driven, right, run by a company. And he's a software engineer. We both went to Mississippi State, but he went 10 years later after me. But he was in town for it. And so getting to see a conference from his eyes, like I tell people, it's like growing up in New Orleans, I've seen, you know, Mardi Gras, like, you know, however years that I'm old. But when you take someone down for the first time to like understand the cultural aspects of it, it's like you get to like relive it for the first time through their eyes. And so it was like really neat to watch him get like all excited about, like, you know, the things that you and I probably as speakers, like seasoned veteran speakers, like, take it for granted these days. But yeah, just to experience it from kind of like a first time conferencer point of view, it made it a lot of fun.
That's really cool. For sure. It was fun for me too. So I think the next GitHub Universe will be late 2018. So, you know, probably October of 2018. But until then, if you missed out on GitHub Universe, GitHub's doing what they call satellite. So there's all these GitHub satellites throughout the world. So you can see talks about GitHub and the GitHub ecosystem and talk to other GitHub users and share tips and tricks. It looks like a lot of fun. I don't know where the nearest one to me is or to you, Sarah, but we can put a link to the GitHub satellite website so that listeners can find the one near them.
Thanks for explaining that. I was trying to remember which one was a bigger conference, the satellite or the universe. But then when you think about size, universe is all encompassing, and then satellite is like, okay, like a local satellite.
That's right.
Branch, conference, office. It's like, oh, okay. Yep. That makes sense.
And there's GitHub Constellation as well, which I think slots in the middle, and it's kind of the mid-sized conference. I know there's one in Tokyo. I think there's a couple others now. GitHub is just putting on so many events. I can't keep up. So thanks for joining us to listen to Sarah and I catch up on what I missed at GitHub Universe. Sarah and I would both love it if you'd give us some feedback on the podcast. If there's something you like, something you don't like, or you want to suggest a guest to us, you can find us on Facebook and on Twitter at All Things Git, or you can email us at podcast@allthingsgit.com. And please go rate us. We're in the iTunes store. We're in the Google Play store. So go give us a rating. If you rate us and you tweet to us about it, we'll send you stickers with the very nifty All Things Git logo. So thanks so much, Sarah, for sitting in for Martin today. I really appreciate you being here and telling me all the things about GitHub Universe that I missed.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks for listening to my, you know, recap from my perspectives.
And thanks for listening. We'll see you on the next episode.